And welcome to another episode of that 4K podcast. Ari Rosen, I'm here with Dan Venturi. Dan, how are you?
I am well, sir. How are you?
I can't complain. I mean, I could, but nobody would really listen.
No one would listen.
This is true. By the time this drops, we'll be in Arlington, Texas for that 4K conference. So, no mind trying to promote that event. Because if you're listening to it right now, that means it's already have taken place or is in the midst of taking place. So let's talk about the events that are going to happen that you could still sign up for. So for that 4K conference, we're going to start off 2020 with a national conference. Walt Disney World Swan, March 10th to 11th, 2020. Great two-day event. A very unique 4K experience. Unique speakers. A whole lot of fun, appearances by former athletes, all that kind of stuff. What you've expected from the 4K conference, but on a greater scale, and of course, a greater, venue. Not to say that some of the stadiums aren't great, but the fact of the matter is nothing beats, to me, nothing beats Walt Disney World. There are a lot of other national events around the country, but this is a family-friendly atmosphere. It's going to be during the week, so you have the weekend to go and be with your family and tour, obviously, the four great parks at Walt Disney World, including the Star Wars Galaxy's Edge, Galaxy's End, there was Galaxy's End, I don't remember which show it's called.
One of them.
Yeah. And if you go to that 4kside.com, you'll get further information as well as the discount link for the park tickets as well as the discount link for the hotel rooms at Walt Disney World Swan. And then after that, what?
I was going to say, that's an important point, the discount that we're talking to, the discounts we're talking about. It's a big deal, guys, right? It's holiday season. What greater gift can you give to your kids, man, than taking them to Disney? And you probably get to write off most of it as a business expense. It's a great opportunity. Come out, have a good time. Learn a lot about the industry. Make some, lasting memories with the family. And have a really good 3, 4, 5 days, however long you're going to be down there.
Exactly. I mean, to me, these events are all about, knowledge and learning new things. Unlike some of the regional events, obviously, this is open to all plan providers, including mm-hmm. TPAs. It's a whole lot of fun. The lasting relationships. I mean, Dan and I, when we've toured around the country already, and, some of the providers we've met, it's really been helpful for business. So, not only do you learn something, you also meet people. And, as I always say, the retirement plan business is a relationship-driven business. And what better place than meeting people at Walt Disney World and, you're having the same interests and you're in the same industry and whatnot. So a great ample times to network and whatnot. After that, we're going to, start the regional events again. Houston will be there on Friday, April 17th. St. Louis, Friday, May 8th. And then Minneapolis, Minnesota, Friday, June 5th. We'll have events, of course, in the fall. And we'll talk about those once those are finalized and booked. Go to that 4kside.com to sign up. The Walt Disney World event, we do have a early bird special. It's a $300 fee to be there. It will increase starting January 1st. So it's and of course, if you're a plan provider, you want to bring a whole bunch of people there. There's a discounted firm ticket as well. Go to that 4kside.com for further information. And of course, for the other regional events, all the events, even for the spring, are already up, including the June event in Minneapolis. If you're interested in sponsoring, if you're interested in coming to our events, again, go to that 4kside.com for further information. Our topic for this week are great 401k features that aren't a fit for every plan sponsor. And, you know, so much of this business is good marketing. You know, there's a lot of great features out there in the retirement plan business that we didn't have, you know, 10, 15 years ago. But I will always say that, you know, when it comes to plan design and plan, you know, issues and services and all that kind of stuff, there really isn't anything that's foolproof, meaning there isn't something out there that's a fit for every plan sponsor. So when you cut through the marketing, as a plan sponsor, you really have to decide whether the services being offered by a said plan provider is something that's actually, you know, a right fit. You know, right off the bat, Safe Harbor 401k plan design. You know, the last 20 years, I was there at the beginning when 401k plan Safe Harbors were finally implemented. I think that was the 1999 was when they were finally allowed. And, you know, they were finally codified into law. And the Safe Harbor plan design was a fantastic opportunity for plans that failed discrimination testing or came close to it. And by offering a required contribution with a notice that's fully vested to plan participants, whether it was a profit-sharing piece or a Safe Harbor match, it was a great opportunity for these plans to avoid testing or to be considered as having passed their testing by offering the Safe Harbor plan design, because otherwise they'd have to come up with a corrective contribution or refunds to plan participants. Later, the IRS decreed that Safe Harbor plan designs would also satisfy top-heavy. And of course, the beauty of the 3% non-elective contribution is that the 3% could be used to satisfy the minimum gateway on new comparability cross-tested plans. It's a great feature, but it's not a fit for everybody, you know? If you're a 401k, yeah.
It's expensive, right? If you're a big company, it costs a lot of money.
Well, it costs a lot of money. The money, you know, even for even smaller businesses, it might be too costly. You know, for certain businesses, giving everybody 3% profit sharing or 4% match or whatever it is, or even a quacka, it's expensive. So not only is it expensive and cost prohibitive for a lot of employers. For a lot of employers, it may not be needed. You know, if you're passing your testing with flying colors, you know, discrimination on the deferral side or the match side really doesn't come into play, or you're not offering a new comparability plan design or whatever it may be, there might be no reason for you to have a Safe Harbor plan design. Even though I love Safe Harbor and those plans have a lot less compliance headaches than those that don't, it's not the right fit for everybody. You know, it's just not the correct fit. And, you know, with anything, you know, if you're looking to adding a Safe Harbor plan design as a plan sponsor or as a plan provider to your clients, realize that it's not a fit for everybody. Look to the nuances of every plan out there that you're working on and see if Safe Harbor plan design is the right fit, because, like I said, it's not a right fit for everybody. And the same can be said about pushing only 401k plans. I know too many plan sponsors who are sold a 401k plan by a TPA or by an advisor where there was something else that could have been done for them. Maybe, you know, maybe a cash balance plan was a great option. Maybe if they're a publicly traded company, maybe a non-qualified plan is a good option. Maybe it's a one-person plan or owner and a spouse, and maybe a defined benefit plan is the right opportunity. I think that in this business, you know, you have too many plan providers out there who only know 401k plans and think that 401k plans are the end-all, be-all for plan sponsors, and that really, really isn't the case. Many years ago, I always talked about it. I had a lawyer called me up and said, is there anything better than a SEP plan? Because he just got like, you know, $300,000 worth of settlements as an attorney. And, you know, whether there was a better opportunity than just putting $40,000-something away. And I asked him how old he was, and he was age 70. And I said, bingo, how about a defined benefit plan? So the defined benefit plan was designed for him. He was able to put away $230,000 that first year. That's by thinking out of the box. That's by looking at every plan sponsor and realizing, you know, you can't have a cookie cutter approach to plan design and a cookie cutter approach to plan types. There isn't a right fit for everybody. Again, that's again the moral of the story. And with its new comparability, you know, using that as cross-tested with Safe Harbor or not, or using the defined benefit plan or cash balance or whatever it may be, you know, you have to look at the totality of the situation and see if other different plan types or plan designs are actually a better fit for the plan sponsor.
Yeah. There are a ton of different ways to take an opportunity. I mean, I think a lot of the variability to what product you place sort of depends on the size of the opportunity, right? To your point, if it's a smaller situation, you know, a DB cash balance situation is ideal. If it's one or, you know, a sole proprietor, solo 401k plans are a lot cheaper than getting regular plans, right? You can do it at Vanguard for basically nothing. Simple IRAs could be a solution for some folks. But I think, you know, once you get past a certain threshold, you know, you're predominantly going to see the K plans out there, right? Bigger companies. DBs are a dinosaur these days, all right, right? They're not a whole lot of them out
there.
There's
not a whole lot of it out there, but, you know, you have a sole proprietor or whatever it is, and, you know, that may be the best solution if they can afford it, you know. And everything out there on plan design is about, you know, affordability. But, you know, in talking about the solo 401k plans, I just came across advisors speaking out to me about, you know, a solo 401k that just hired its first employee. And I said, well, can't use a solo 401k anymore if the employee is not your spouse. So, you know, there's caveats with these small plans as well. You know, SEPs aren't great if you want to offer, you know, if you want to have a different contribution for, you know, highly compensated employees, because with a SEP, everybody's going to get the same rate of pay contribution. So that doesn't work as well. You know, the point is that, you know, every client is different. Every plan sponsor is different. So, you know, you can't have a one-size-fits-all. You know, maybe it works well with Halloween costumes. You know, doesn't really necessarily work well with, you know, plan design. I know it doesn't work well with plan design. We have too many plan sponsors out there that really just don't have the right fit. You know, it's like kids' clothes. You know, there's a certain point your kids outgrow their clothes, and, you know, there are times where you outgrow a 401k plan design, especially one that's, you know, offering a comp-to-comp contribution. Next, automatic enrollment of 401k plans. Again, I love that feature. When it first came out, I thought it was the worst thing ever. The reason why I thought automatic enrollment was the worst thing ever is because it was developed as part of an advisory opinion. It was a client who asked for it, and it was called the negative election. I think it was developed in 98 or 1999. And the problem with automatic enrollment was that because at that point there was no such thing as QDIA, that therefore anybody using this negative election could only park the money in like a money market or stable value fund. So to me, automatic enrollment was just a cheap gimmick to inflate the deferral rate of a plan. And so I thought it was something out of communist Russia, communist Soviet Union. So I thought it was the worst thing ever. When it was codified into law in 2006 and they finally allowed it and called it automatic enrollment, it allowed participants to get the money back if they changed their mind. But most importantly, the advent of the QDIA, where plan sponsors would not have any fiduciary breaches by parking money into a QDIA. You know, the participants obviously didn't direct because they were automatically enrolled. Automatic enrollment is not a good fit for clients who have a very good deferral rate. You know, to me, a law firm isn't somebody who really needs automatic enrollment. Automatic enrollment really is for, you know, plan sponsors where they really need the non-highly compensated employees to defer more. either because they want them to or because to help with testing. For a lot of clients out there, it's just not the right fit. You know, you may also have a business where automatically enrolling people is a bad idea, because you'll have to deal with them, you know, when they come complaining, when they start seeing that paycheck get decreased by the automatic enrollment contribution.
High turnover businesses are no good.
That's a perfect example. Exactly. High turnover, the headaches of dealing with small account balances. You know, I worked for a business once, worked for a certain TPA where I jokingly said that the front door should have had a revolving door built in because we used to have a high turnover. That would not have been a good place to have automatic enrollment. Next on the list, a corporate trustee. To me, a corporate trustee, only two reasons you should have one is, number one, nobody wants to serve as the trustee of the plan, no individual. And most importantly, number two, they have a plan audit. You know, putting in a corporate trustee when you have a plan audit saves you on corporate expenses. It saves you on audit expenses because the audit, the trust company could self-certify their own statements. That means they would qualify the plan to have a limited scope audit. As the name suggests, limited scope means it's going to be a lesser fee, lesser audit fee. So plan sponsors who hire a corporate trustee for a couple grand end up saving a lot more on the audit side by offering a corporate trustee. You know, a corporate trustee doesn't, you know, shield the plan sponsor from liability. It doesn't really help for small plans. The only two circumstances where I think that they're a fit is when you have a business where nobody wants to serve as the trustee of the plan, and more importantly, number two, when there's a plan audit.
Yeah, we put corporate trustees in all the plans. It's a no-brainer.
Yeah, well, that's when you have plans that require an audit.
Yeah. Anybody over that 100-employee threshold.
Yeah, otherwise it makes no sense. Up your alley, Dan. One thing that's not a fit for every plan sponsor is a 316 plan administrator. Yeah, you're in the 316 business. There are certain plan sponsors out there that really don't need it. Obviously a larger business, they have a really well-trained staff, real educated staff. 316 might just be something that they really don't need.
Yeah. What we're finding is there's a lot of turnover, and, inevitably that institutional memory of the plan sort of leaves with the turnover. Right, the HR person's not there for 10 years anymore. The CFO is not there for 10 years anymore. So sort of being that the touchstone for the plan is something that's proven to be of a lot of value to our bigger clients. And to your point, but you know, if the staff is educated and they know what they're doing, I agree with you entirely. But you know, what we see a lot of times is they aren't very educated in terms of, you know, the nuances of running a program, which is why, you know, the vast majority of plans that you see have something wrong with them, right? They could be minor issues. It could just be a tardy or an untimely contribution, but, ultimately you're right. It's not a perfect fit for everyone. There are definitely a lot of well-run plans out there, a lot of companies that put the time and the money and the resources into HR and developing folks, but at the same time, there's quite a few that don't.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I once had a client working for a law firm where, you know, the head of the plan or whatever, the day-to-day administrator person at the industry, whatever, was a union client. I was a certified employee benefit specialist, so you know that's. Uh-huh. That's somebody who really didn't need the services of 316 administrator. They were really up on their stuff. They knew a lot more than even some ERISA attorneys out there. So there really wasn't a need for that, cost. But most importantly, that support that a 316 administrator like somebody like you provides, you have well-trained staff, knows what the heck they're doing. 316 isn't a right fit. It's good for the smaller business or staff where, the person in charge of the plan really has no background in retirement plans and needs somebody there to, find the way have administration that works easily and avoids the headaches that a plan sponsor has to go through.
Mm-hmm.
And last but not least, on this, ERISA 338 fiduciary. Same thing with the 316. I know, obviously, 338 is kind of the new standard that RIAs offer. It's really gone that, 10 years ago, I 12 years ago, I didn't know what a 338 fiduciary was. And then advisors started to take on that role. And to me, some brokers will say, oh, it's just marketing. No, it's a great service. The idea that the advisor would assume the liability and the day-to-day control of the fiduciary process of the plan, that's fantastic on paper. But when you got a plan sponsor that's really up on their stuff, very knowledgeable, knows the idea that, they have to, follow what the advisor says and meet regularly with the advisor and have plan enrollment education meetings, then there really is no need to have a 338 fiduciary. A 321 or even, obviously a stockbroker or whatever, whatever role that is, that may be all that they need. 338s aren't expensive, but if they don't need that level of care, then they don't need it. It's just you're paying, for something that you don't need. And I will say that there are plan sponsors out there, that are control freaks. I'm a control freak. I may not want to see that day-to-day control. And there'll be plan sponsors out there that want to be in the loop. And by hiring a 338 fiduciary, they may think that they're out of the loop and aren't, following up on the day-to-day plans as well. And the same thing with 316. Is the plan sponsor willing to give up some control? And, quite honestly, you will find plan sponsors out there that for some reason or another just don't want to do that. And I get it.
We run into them.
We run into it all the time. Sometimes I always think the worst situations is when you're talking on the phone with a client and their attorney, not their ERISA attorney, but their corporate attorney, and it's the corporate attorney who's blocking you from getting that client because they're telling their client, oh, you don't need this. Plan sponsors don't get sued like you, that kind of stuff. And, sometimes that corporate attorney, they're just sticking the wheels of progress and sticking the wheel of a successful sale, for your services. But, I think the whole purpose of that is whether you're a 401k plan sponsor or a plan provider, you got to realize that there's nothing out there that's a right fit for everybody. Listen, I love full vesting. I don't put that in for all my clients because for a lot of clients, full vesting is awful. Especially like you said, if you have a company with a huge turnover. There's quite a lot of things with plan provisions and plan features that I love, but I realize that I'd be doing a disservice to my clients by having a one-size-fits-all for all these type of provisions and choices and whatnot with the 401k plans.
Agreed. Entirely.
So that's about it for this episode of that 401k podcast. We'll be back next week with another episode. Of course, every Friday. And of course, once again, go to that 401ksite.com for further information about all our events.
Have a great weekend.
Take care.